Saturday.
What day is it today?
Wednesday.
Exactly.
Welcome to Film Fight Club. I'm Falcon from Falcon Screen, and we are joined by Sydney filmmaker Chris Evans.
Ding, ding.
Hello. And freelance writing critic for Nehru.
Hello.
And joining us as a very special guest is the director of the Korean Film Festival in Australia, which is celebrating its 10th year this year. It is kicking off in Sydney tomorrow night at Denny Cinema's Opera Keys. David Park, the artistic director of the festival. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So later in the program, we're going to be talking about the Melbourne International Film Festival, and on the podcast, we will be talking Once Upon a Time in Hollywood spoilers, so you can listen to our regular review last week, but this will be a spoiler discussion, no holds barred.
Officially the 9th film by Quentin Tarantino, not the 10th.
I've heard that a lot.
We'll get to hear Virat's take on it as well.
Oh, God, okay. Yeah, sure.
But that is later, because we are talking all things Coffia. Now, the festival is kicking off tomorrow. It is the 10th year. We're keen to hear about some of the films, but first of all, it's the 10th year. You must have pulled out some stops.
We're really happy with what we've been able to achieve with our lineup this year. So, 22 films in total, and Sydney is getting every single one of them. Because our other cities don't usually have the full lineup, but we're happy to have that here. Some really interesting films that will be going over a lot of the main genres that makes Korean cinema so popular. Yeah, so I'm really interested to see the audience reaction for these films.
Mm. So the Korean Film Festival, some of these films are showing for the first time in Sydney, and some of them are sort of a retrospective of films that have played already. So who are you trying to hopefully bring into these films with the Korean Film Festival?
Yeah, so 22 of the films are pretty much, I guess, a showcase of... Mm. I guess we're celebrating the films that have really made an impact in the industry in the past year.
Mm.
And we're really excited to be working with Sydney Film Festival this year to be presenting a retrospective of Bong Joon-ho's films.
Mm.
Since I think it makes sense because he's taken home the Sydney Best Film Prize and the Palme d'Or. He's definitely the number one most talked about director in Korea, if not
I think world. Chris's heartbeat is just like increasing by the minute as you talk about it, because I can just see him blushing as you talk about Bong Joon-ho.
It's nice to see him hit this level of recognition.
Right, so you've been obviously following his...
Yeah, I've been following his career since, I think, Memories of Murder. Mm-hmm. The Host hadn't quite come out yet when I got into his stuff, so yeah, it's been a while.
So we'll be pretty much screening everything from Barking Dogs, Never Bite, we'll have Memories of Murder, we'll have Mother, we'll have Host. Yeah, so it should be quite interesting.
Yeah, they're great films.
And
Parasite, no less. It's probably the most discussed film on the show. It's my favorite film of the year. I do think it's the best film of 2019. And we were very lucky to have director Bong Joon-ho. I know Chris spoke to him earlier in the year as well. And I'm very keen to hear your thoughts on Parasite. I mean, it's such a consequential and significant movie. And I'm so glad that audiences are going to get another opportunity to see it.
Yeah, I think it's only right that we programmed it for this year, because obviously it's one of the biggest films. It did have a domestic release here in Australia and New Zealand, but ticket sales for that particular film are just through the roof. I think we'll definitely get another full house for that one, which is great to see.
I feel like the film can go even further with its international rollout. You never know if this is going to break through for career at the Oscars.
Definitely. I mean, it's
a chance, I think.
It's definitely one of those rare occasions where Australia gets a film before the US.
And that's true.
For once, the US fans are like, oh my God, this is what it feels like to wait for a movie.
But it's a really interesting film that seems to have united people. It seems like, you know, the highbrow, the less artsy critics, the general audiences, everyone's on board with it.
Yeah, I went with some of my friends who were hardcore Fast and Furious franchise fans.
Yeah.
And they were not disappointed. No. But they were like, they would never go to see an art house movie, if you know what I mean, right? But they were pleasantly surprised by the genre uptake of this movie. And they were like, no, this is entertaining. And they were kind of surprised by how entertained they were. And I'm like, no, you know, sometimes I watch good movies. So this is one of them.
No, that was a really good, interesting observation, guys. Because a lot of my friends who would never go in to see these films were like saying, what is Parasite? What is this film that everyone is talking about? we have to go into the cinemas to see this thing. And yeah, I mean, the film racked up to become the number one sold filled in Korean film in Australia and New Zealand. So yeah, it's a huge testament to that.
It's a really interesting, universal kind of premise, I think, that a lot of people can relate to it.
Now, another film I'm keen to talk about, which is, I think, a premiere for the festival, is The Odd Family. Now, there's a lot of action-orientated films, but there's one screening early in the festival, and it's one I'm particularly keen for. I think it's screening Friday night.
Yes, Friday night. So we've kind of had our own in-house little idea to screen our zombie films on that one night. So we're screening The Odd Family first, and then Rampant, which is another take on the zombie genre. So Odd Family is a really interesting film, I think, because it's very rare for a zombie film to be set in Korea. Train to Busan was a very big example of a zombie film, but that was probably one or two of a myriad of Korean films. So you can't say that there's been a lot. But it's really interesting how we've already been able to try and play on the genre to the extent that we got The Odd Family. And for those that don't know, The Odd Family is set in a very hillbilly rural Korean town, and this family stumbles upon a zombie, and they realize that once the people are bitten by this particular zombie, they age in reverse. So it's kind of like a youth elixir. So the bite becomes a youth elixir for these guys, and they end up selling the zombie's bite to the people in the town. Now, what happens later is, as with all good fashion zombie films, everyone that's been bitten suffers the after effects of the infection. They all turn into zombies, and it's just this one family trying to, set everything right in this really comedic take on the zombie genre.
We see a lot of zombie films, and some of them can be quite generic, quite straightforward. It's nice to see that they're actually really
dead, don't die.
Absolutely. A perfect example. And it's nice to see that there is a novel approaches to these issues. I mean, zombies and films have always been about social issues and social anxiety, and this seems to feed very squarely into that.
Yeah. And I think it's a film that takes itself very lightly, kind of in the vein of Zombieland or Shaun of the Dead. And I mean, for Korea to kind of try that so early into the whole zombie thing, I think it was really interesting to see the industry do that.
I'm very intrigued by the Hong Sang-soo that you're screening, Hotel by the River.
Yes.
Because I guess Hong Sang-soo is a favorite of, like Bong. I guess
film festival audiences, and no one else. If you want to see movies at a film festival about people at film festivals, Hong Sang-soo is your man.
I didn't want to say that, but I do think Hong Sang-soo and Kim Min-hee is a very good and very interesting director-actor collaboration, which is, I think they've done some amazing work together. And off screen and on screen. Sorry. But I think, it's interesting to see. Just the pace of his output is really cool and clever. So, his ability to script a screenplay. So it's going to be interesting, because I think I got into Korean cinema through Hong Sang-soo's work. So Yeah, so it's now interesting to see what people can expect from his latest.
I think he's such an interesting director, isn't he? And I would just love to be where he is right now, just in terms of his creativity and what he's been able to achieve. He has his own aesthetic, which doesn't really cost much budget-wise, and he's able to freely express anything, and he has a huge following, and it resonates people in a way. And I'll just love to have that platform if I was to direct a film. I think that's the dream level that you kind of get to.
He's just a friend of mine from Korea made the comment that his movies and his life are just inseparable. He's just constantly expressing his current situations through film.
Exactly.
What? Imagine having that kind of platform, as you say.
Yeah, exactly.
There is a director searching for meaning in almost all his films. Yeah. Like, yeah, why not?
So, yeah, I mean, you could kind of say, oh, he's just sitting on the bench and he's just thinking. And then he'd just go, hey, this is a great idea of me having a great idea. Yeah. Why don't I invest in a film crew and just shoot this?
Yeah.
And people come in and watch it thoroughly enjoy it, myself included. Yeah.
Living his best life right now.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm, I mean.
Yeah. The other film I wanted to talk about, which actually saw it back in Sydney Film Festival, is Spy Gone North, which I think a lot of people missed out during the festival run, but I really liked it, and I think it's really gritty, you know, good mystery kind of noir style, and very grounded, very realistic, once again using the Korean setting really well, which I think, let's expand upon that, because I think a lot of people missed out when the festival run happened.
Yeah, and that was actually, I think, playing on several cinemas had picked that up to screen as well. I think it's always a little iffy when we get to that period drama espionage, especially when you have North Korea involved, because you can't separate politics from film and art in that genre. But I think it's been done really well. And Hwang Jung-min, I mean, I watch anything that he's in. I mean, he's just a seal of approval right there. I think he's very good at selecting the scripts that he wants to work with. And I think this film is a very good testament to his ability to pick and analyze.
Yeah, I was very surprised how under the radar it kind of happened. And so I'm really keen that people do check it out now that it's getting a proper rerun, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's done some festival runs, but it's interesting how it just didn't pick up.
I heard about it when it was showing out of competition at Cannes Film Festival. I noticed that they, in recent years, seem to have a trend of showing a dark Korean genre movie every year. So we had The Spy Gone North, but also, I think it was last year, and it's in your schedule as well, The Gangster, The Cop, The Devil.
Yeah. That's screened as a midnight screening.
Right.
I remember. And we've got that program for this year as well.
Yeah.
I think that's a terrific, terrific genre film.
The premise is fantastic.
Yeah.
It's. Do you want to tell us about it?
Oh. So basically, it's about a cop and a gangster who has to work together to find a serial killer. And, you know, just right there, you've got the whole dynamics of these people from polar opposite sides of the moral scale working together to find someone that is extremely outside the bounds of the moral scale. So it's very interesting in that already. But
great.
And we've changed tack quite a bit, actually. I was reading the program, and I'll be seeing this in the coming week, the film The Odd Couple, comedy in a sense, where two individuals from quite different backgrounds come together to support each other, and then someone comes into a mix, like the mother of one of the main characters, which leads to potentially upending their situation.
Yeah, so Inseparable Bros is going to be a... I guess it's one of the... It definitely falls in the genre which a lot of Korean fans like. The bright, colorful... quirky, funny. This is where a lot of the films that initially brought Korean cinema to the international audience, well, for the mainstream international audience, like My Sassy Girl, fall in under. And I think Inseparable Bros is a really good example of that. But this is a bromance film. So two guys who are not related by blood are brought together in a facility for people with disability. And so one of the characters is, I guess he's, how do I put it nicely? he's not all there in the head. But he's physically very gifted and very strong. Whereas the other one is physically disabled from neck down, but his mind is perfect, and he's very clever. So he acts as the brains. The other character, the brother, acts as the brawn. And it's a very interesting dynamic there already. And I guess the film starts to kick off into motion when the complication arises of someone who pretends to be, or who comes out saying that she is the mother of one of the characters. And yeah, it definitely delves into the issue of what is family? Is blood thicker than water, or is can there be more to that?
Kind of like us guys, right? Inseparable bros.
We've been talking about the, remember, just as the name of the show, maybe this could, we may miss an opportunity here. Inseparable,
yeah. Inseparable bros.
Bros,
yeah.
Exactly. Hang loose, guys. Hang loose.
One of, okay, it's not quite the same, but a
segue. Go for that segue, Chris.
Yeah, I tried to
commit to this now.
I was going to say that Extreme Job, it was one of those sort of bright, accessible, yes, movies, but I wouldn't quite put it in the My Sassy Girl category. I didn't see this one, but a friend told me it was great earlier this year, who isn't normally into Korean films especially, so I think it's one that also has big crossover potential.
Yeah, Extreme Job. Ooh, it was probably one of the biggest films of the year.
Yeah, I noticed. I kept hearing about it, and it was going on for a while at the cinemas.
It was huge. It was huge. I guess that's partly, I don't want to take any credit away from the film itself, but it was partly owing to the fact that it didn't really have a big competitor when it rolled out, right, in the domestic cinemas. But that being said, I mean, director Lee Byung-hun, I think it's third or fourth film, but he's really been able to flourish into the genre that he's been cultivating for the past films. I mean, I've seen his past films. We've actually programmed a few in our festival a few years back, but he's definitely flourished into that comedic genre, which actually has a nice, intense plot and can hold itself together until the end. And I think that's where Extreme Job really excelled, because it does end on a very big, well, what's the word that I'm searching for?
Extreme reveal?
Climax.
I like how you use the word extreme.
Yeah.
Those were our films, but like, is there a film that...
Yeah, honestly, may just have the best premise of the year. I mean, Unknown Saint was pretty good, but Extreme Job, it's a great idea.
Staking out a drug operation, accidentally create a massively successful fast food business.
Yeah,
why wouldn't you?
Why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
So they set up a fried chicken shop, and, you know, Korea's been quite on the map for their Korean fried chicken. And these guys, one of the constables has this homemade recipe that they want to try out. It becomes a massive hit. So these guys are meant to be, you know, obviously watching, yeah, for these drug lords that are opposite the street. But now they have a dilemma of this shop going so well.
I get it. Like, it's two of my favorite things as well. I mean, fried chicken and drugs. So I guess, you know, it brings two of my greatest loves together. I would love to see this movie.
I think we're seeing this movie together.
Okay.
It's from Fight Club Outing.
Yeah.
Definitely would love to have you guys. Yeah, join us for the screening. And it's a blast. I mean, it's just one of those films where you can just watch and just let everything that's on your mind just kind of float away and just laugh.
Too many depressing movies, to be honest. And it's good to just see a movie and just not think about something.
Mm.
Yeah. But are there any other films that you potentially would recommend and say that, you know, we might have missed out, but one of your favorites in the program that we kind of haven't touched upon?
I guess, you know, kind of, they're all my babies in a sense. But I am very passionate about our opening film, A Resistance. So 2019 marks two big anniversaries. So it's the 100th anniversary of Korean cinema. So our first films were produced since 1919. So we had six films produced then. Fast forward 100 years, we're projected to have about 600 domestic releases. So yeah, it's a very good statistic. The other anniversary is 100 years of the provisional government. So this is huge for our country. So we've had our first government 100 years ago. And one of the key figures in the activists who, you know, helped make this happen is the lead in the film of A Resistance, which is our opening film this year. So Yu Guansun, she was 17 years old when she was put into a Japanese colonial prison, and she died there. But that story just resonated so hugely with the Korean people. And I think the choice was, you know, I'm getting a few people and some opinions saying, hey, is this a bit risk? It's a bit political, but just felt that it was the perfect film to just open the year on.
Mm. There are a lot of films I've noticed in the program this year that are looking at new angles on the time of the Japanese occupation.
Yeah, yeah.
It's almost like a mini theme through the program.
Yeah, I mean, we don't hate Japan. I just want to put that out there. Yeah. But I think it's just a very important part of our history. Mm. And it helped develop us. It helped give us a lot of scope on where we needed to be. I mean, it shaped us to the country we are now. So I think it's just only important for a country to look back on those things and... yeah, reflect.
Indeed, very much so.
If I can get political, especially if there's opposition to those stories being remembered and being told.
You would hope not. You would hope sincerely not, but that's... I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, I mean, Chris, I mean, it's... a lot of people don't know that there are oppositions to the story, but yeah, it's alarming to see how much there is. And I guess that's why a lot of the filmmakers have been kind of getting busy trying to...
It makes sense. It's like, it's amazing the number you mentioned before, Korea having like 600 domestic releases a year. That's huge. That's a really healthy cinema landscape. And then within there, I guess it's like, okay, Korea really has its own national cinema to be proud of. What sort of stories is it important for Korea to tell right now?
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, with the whole... Japan and Korea trade war going on right now. I think culture is a very soft and nice way to say, hey guys, like, let's sort this out, you know, let's talk over this. And it's a nice diplomatic way to just have our message out there, you know, instead of going to drastic measures like, oh, let's boycott every single Japanese product. Because I think that does go a little extreme, but film is just on the right margin. You know, you have your freedom of speech, you have your freedom of expression, and yeah, we'll go from there.
Yeah, fair enough. I think it makes a lot of sense.
Thank you for raising that. I mean, we've been doing the show a while. We never actually talked properly about film as a form of expression, a broader political expression and self-actualization, and it's so significant. So I do hope people do seek out these films and do go to the festival, which is starting tomorrow night and running through to the 31st and then the Opera Keys. Mm-hmm. For those who want to go see one or more or many of these movies, how do we go? How do we get there?
Yeah, so www.kofia.com.au. So that's an abbreviation of our film festival. So kofia.com.au. That's our website. All our venues, our schedule, our film lineup, everything's there. You can book online or you can book at our venue. We're at, as you mentioned, Dendy Opera Keys this year for Sydney. So, yeah, socials, we've got Facebook. We're on Instagram, so Korean Film Festival in Australia, and hopefully it pops up. Hopefully. Crossing my fingers, yeah.
Well, come join us to celebrate 10th birthday. It's a big year.
And the 100th birthday of Korean cinema.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. And our birthday is on Film Fight Club as well, actually.
Yeah, it's birthday week. Happy birthday to both Virat and Chris for the coming week. Wow.
Thank you.
Yeah, all in one time.
Yeah.
Happy birthday, Virat.
Happy birthday, Chris.
Happy birthday, guys.
Thank you.
And we'll be back right after this, talking all things Melbourne International Film Festival. Stay tuned.
To SER wishes to acknowledge the custodians of the land from which we broadcast, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and the Wadumatagal clan of the Darug Nation, and their elders past, present and emerging. We acknowledge and respect their continuing culture and the contribution they make to the life of this city and this region.
This September, brace yourself as Sydney Fringe turns 10, celebrating with over 350 shows across 60 venues over 30 days. Offering work from 11 different genres, including theatre, comedy, music, dance, circus, experiential events, and much more. This year's program is live and ready to go, so grab your tickets at sydneyfringe.com. 2SER is a media partner of Sydney Fringe.
Sydney Latin American Film Festival is coming soon. Our city's most fun and vibrant celebration of independent cinema. Famous for their opening and closing night fiestas and Q&A sessions, you'll discover more than just your new favourite movies. Running from September 4th to 21st at Dendy Opera Keys, Addison Road Picture House, and now also at Casula Powerhouse. For tickets and more information, head to slaff.org.au. 2SER is a media partner of Sydney Latin American Film Festival.
Welcome back to Film Fight Club. I can vouch for that ad in that I've been to the Sydney Latin American Film Festival every past several years, and they do have the best opening night parties. The Irish Film Festival give them a run for their money, but the slaff is pretty great.
Yeah, they're quite slaffing with their parties.
And
they slaff hard with a vengeance.
And Giselle, the director of the festival, will be on next week to chat all things in Latin American Film Festival and parties and Anderson Picture House, which they're making excellent use of, a beautiful and very underused venue.
I'd like to point out I don't go to parties unless it's a slaff party. So, yeah, there you go.
And we will be there September 4th. Book your tickets. So, and also at Dendy Opera Keys, I think.
Yeah.
At least they'll be in that film. So,
it's the happening place in town.
The other happening place in town, well, the town we were just in, I literally got off a plane and came straight here, was the Melbourne International Film Festival.
Yeah, my one true love.
It wrapped after 18 glorious days of film, some of the best stuff from Sydney, some new stuff, some premieres, some great, some all right, and some truly terrible. And we're going to be, Verona and I visited the lovely city of Melbourne and all its coffee. I've had a lot of coffee and wired, and Rutt is going to talk about, first of all, about his flicks that he caught at this year's Melbourne International Film Festival.
Yes, so I did a very interesting double bill. I did The Art of Self-Defense, which is the new Jesse Eisenberg movie where Jesse Eisenberg is playing, well, Jesse Eisenberg
again. Which
is
screening at the Sydney Underground Film Festival on September 14, the Saturday evening.
And
tickets are available.
And the Takashi Miike film, First Love, which is also screening at the Sydney Underground Film Festival.
I wish I could tell you the time it was. Oh, I can. Give me 1 second. Continue, Verad. I'll just grab my booklet.
Yeah, and this was a very interesting double bill. And thankfully, Saf have picked up both the films. And it is a very exciting double bill for me. It was Friday night. And I was like, you know, what the hell? I'm going to do it. They're both really interesting, fun films for very different reasons. Firstly, The Art of Self-Defense, which is a very, very dumb film. And I say that with as much love as possible because the film is really dumb, but it's so clear in the first 5 minutes exactly how dumb the film is that for the rest of the runtime, you kind of just enjoy it for how dumb it is because the premise is so dumb, but it's so funny that you're just like, okay, there is no way in hell anyone can take Jesse Eisenberg seriously as someone who is an expert in karate.
I just want to point out that this film has Alessandra Duvall, who played David in Disobedience, and also played Pollux Troy in Face Off. This guy has incredible range, and he was in Jurassic World 3, underrated movie.
Yes. This film is one of my favorite gags.
Jurassic Park 3?
Oh my God, I did it again. Jurassic Park 3. Excuse me, Steven Spielberg.
Yeah, the Art of Self-Defense is one of my favorite gags about belts. Where
better than John Wick 3?
Yes, where the characters are, Jesse Eisenberg's character basically, you know, brings a whole load of belts for people to wear casually outside of their karate school. So instead of bringing, you know, because, you know, as in karate, you have, you know, different colors of belts to propagate your level of expertise. So he instead brings people black belts so that, you know, people can essentially wear them casually outside.
We're going to be talking more about The Art of Self-Defense and the other Melbourne International Film Festival films.
That's so dumb.
On the podcast. Subscribe on iTunes and Spotify if you're listening to the podcast. Just keep listening. Coffia@.com.au. So that's Koffia.com.au. The festival's going to be playing at Dendy Opera Keys from tomorrow through to the 31st of August. Do check it out. We will be there. Come say hi. And we'll also be talking Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, spoilers in the podcast, full and spoiler discussion, regular reviews last week, but We're going full blown into it. This has been Glenn Falconson, Chris Evans, and Virat Nehru. Stay tuned for The Sonic Assassin. Have a wonderful night. Enjoy movies. Good night.
Bye.
And we're back on the Film Fight Club podcast, talking all things Melbourne International Film Festival. And Virat was teaching us some self-defense.
Yes. Okay. The art of self-defense and how exactly dumb it is. So, yeah, we're talking about black belts. So J.C. Eisenberg essentially is playing a character who's, like all J.C. Eisenberg characters, quite neurotic, basically needs to enroll himself into a self-defense class to...
I think Mark Zuckerberg is bodyguards, but sure.
Yes. Or essentially to kind of feel more masculine. And in a way, the social commentary in this movie about what masculinity means and how do you want to like become more macho and, you know, learning self-defense kind of thing could be interesting, but it's so dumb that, like, you know, like, after the first 5 minutes, you just can't take it seriously, and that's exactly the tone the movie's going for. Except if that irritates you, which I can see how it can divide people, because the movie is so dumb. Like, it's so dumb. It's kind of like Swiss Army Man dumb. But, like, you know...
We'll get
shots fired.
The best film in 2016, what? We'll get into Swiss Army Man later when we talk about The Death of Dick Long.
You know, but the thing is, I kind of got into it, and it's definitely better than the other Jesse Eisenberg Imogen Poots movie, which is playing at MIFF, which is Vivarium, which was just flat out terrible.
I didn't realize you saw it.
Yeah, I saw that too, because I was like, you know, I'm seeing both. So that movie is just terrible, and that movie has got nothing going for it. Thankfully, this movie is at least funny and dumb, which are two things I can get behind. That movie is just dumb. So, you know, if you're going for a dumb movie, at least be self-aware about your dumbness and at least, you know, play on that. Which moves me on to Takashi Miike and First Love. Miike is... I'm so enamored by the fact that he's now entered the zone. Like, Blade of the Immortal, I saw that, and, like, there's some visuals that are still imprinted in my brain about how funnily self-indulgent that movie is. And now Miike is just doing that again with First Love, where he's playing on a lot of the gangster tropes that, you know, he's basically inverted in all his movies, like 100 plus now. And so this movie is essentially about a boxer who finds out that he's terminally ill, and he realizes that he's lost motivation to do anything in life, but eventually certain things happen and he crosses paths with a young girl who is in need of protection. So he makes it his mission to protect her as one of the last acts he would do before he would die. I know this sounds like a pretty dramatic premise, but it's not. It's just played for laughs throughout the entire film. And a lot of the Takashi Miike's sort of stylistic style in this movie is very much driven from comic book culture, but quite, instead of making it comic booky, it's mostly actually, there are scenes that like pivot into right out of a comic book. Mm-hmm. So you kind of see a lot of those scenes drawn out and then like emerging in real life, kind of like Scott Pilgrim and like Edgar Wright style. So it was interesting seeing Miike go into that zone and territory, being flat out, making into a proper comic book kind of story.
He's a really experimental director, I think, always trying out different things.
And it's interesting also with the Yakuza and the gang war turfs in what this movie is playing up with. This movie has some hilarious scenes. There is a one-arm gangster who's literally basically named the one-arm gangster. One-arm Wang is what he's called, precisely because he's got one arm. So like it's that level of like superficially dumb, but it's
Bleeding Gums Murphy, why is he called that?
I know, but it's fun because it's interesting in the sense how this movie plays up the gang war sort of, you know, trope in a very comedic sense. The kind of usually cliched played for dramatic tension scenes of, you know, the shootout between two gangs, which happens in these kind of movies, is one of the highlights of the movie because exactly how much of a comedy of errors that scene is. In that scene, the characters kind of see each other and then go completely over the top dramatic and trying to kill each other, except they can't do it. So it's drawn out like a Buster Keaton style comedic parable. So it was interesting to see that kind of physical comedy being played out, which you don't get to see in a lot of American cinema anymore. So Miike is really inventive in how it uses actual physical gags,
right,
peppered throughout the film. So I would definitely recommend. This was a great double bill if you're looking for plain dumb fun. So at SAF, I think it's exactly the kind of film SAF would like go for, and I'm excited. The SAF crowd really love it. I think this was a great double bill.
Cool. Yes, you can catch the SAF Film Festival. It's the Underground Film Festival, the 13th one at the Marrickville Factory Theatre from September 12th to 15th. I'm not lying when I say I will literally be there the entire weekend, except when I'm popping out to see SF3. But yeah, it's my favourite 4 days.
They have a party, right? The cereal party, if I'm
honest. They're not doing the cereal party this year, sadly, which is the early morning and late night breakfast, a cartoon party. They are having an opening party on the Thursday night and a closing, which is the Beach Bum themed, the new Matthew McConaughey film, and the closing night party is tied with The Lodge, the new Riley Coe film.
But, you know, you might just walk out because, you know, it might be the Vampire, Tokyo Vampire Hotel.
Again.
It might be a Sienzo movie and you might just not want to stay for it.
But there's none of those
Who
films,
knows?
So
yeah.
It's not going to happen. And The Art of Self-Defense is playing, so...
I don't know, The Art of Walking Out of the Cinema is really your thing.
This is a... Well, technically the film hadn't started, so I didn't leave. I've never walked out of a movie to this day. Sure. I know people did it at Melbourne's National Film Festival.
Walked into the cinema and then walked right out.
I saw something else. I saw another movie about, a very sensitive one, about a man... who was talking about his experience being visited by aliens and the drawings he would draw and the art he created, which was
quite stunning. I don't think
that's
a sufficient defense, but I'll give it to you.
Oh, you're on fire with your September-themed film festival puns. Just, yep, I'm not bad. So we'll see how we can do with some of the films I'm about to talk about.
Okay. But yeah, you also saw some myth films, so yeah, let's just myth them out.
Yeah, I saw 10. I'm not going to talk about all of them. I'm going to talk about some of the highlights.
Some of the lowlights.
You beat me to it.
Oh.
I was just going to the microphone just then.
Oh, just this obvious. But that's the one patently obvious one. Otherwise, it's
I was miffed.
There were
miffed in Melbourne.
I was. Yeah. We're Little Zombies, A Hidden City. Some I wouldn't necessarily run seeking out. One is a 2-hour film about kids who lose their family in the worst Strawberry Aficionados tour ever.
Alice
and former J-pop
Alice
band,
was
of course.
Okay, from what I heard.
I didn't see Alice. I wanted to, but I missed. The timing didn't work out, unfortunately. What I did see, and I'll bring it up first because it has come up so far, is The Death of Dick Long, which is from Daniel Schneider, one of the directors of Sami Man. It's a new film from A24. It has its national premiere at the Melbourne Film Festival. And it is one that defies stratification in terms of genre. It is about the disappearance of the titular Dick Long, and obviously the two main characters, ostensibly his two best friends, are clearly no more than they're letting on. And the cops and the respective partners of the three main male characters wonder what is going on here. Look, whether you enjoy this or not is really going to come down to your thoughts on a twist. The twist has the rare impact of appearing to upend tone and genre even when it doesn't. It's very well, the groundwork's very well laid. It makes a lot of sense. I like twist. It will turn a lot of people off. Nash and Moodley, I remember, mentioned to us when we were talking about Simon a while ago, and that when he saw it at the Cannes Film Festival, a lot of people walked out. The ones who didn't walk out stayed and cheered. I think it's going to be a pretty similar divide down people who either detest and dislike The Death of Dick Long, or like myself, who I wish I could say I liked nearly as much as Osama Man, but the fact is it had the frustrating, what's the terrible Iron Fist series, where you have three main male characters who are front and center, but to a degree, but are the least interesting characters, least interesting arc, whereas the three main female characters are performing much better actors and are much more interesting characters with better arcs, but they unfortunately take... more on the sidelines of this, and I wish that hadn't been the case because those performers therein were very, very good.
That's part of the irony, right? Having stronger female characters in a movie called Dick Long.
Oh, The Death of Dick Long.
Well, it is The Death of Dick Long because the female characters are the ones that are interesting.
Anyway. Right. So, yeah.
no comment.
I don't know what to say to that.
No comment from me on Swiss Army Man. I know we're on a schedule today, and
yes.
I don't want to open those floodgates.
It'll overtake Parasite as the most discussed film in the show. I guarantee it if we ever come
most
to discussing it. We're glad to discuss it.
Yeah.
Like, but it's okay.
Yeah.
We should have a proper fight about Swiss Army Man one day.
With pleasure. With absolute pleasure.
Pleasure is not my word for it, but it's okay.
The next film we want to talk about is So brilliant. It's a masterpiece.
So
it really is, without exaggeration.
Oh, my God.
So should I jump into something else? Okay, now we're getting into Simon.
Yeah, right. Let's get to The Farewell.
The Farewell is the new film from Lulu Wang. It was the closing night film at the Melbourne International Film Festival, and she came out for the screening, the premiere, and the Q&A. It is starring Awkwafina of Ocean's 8 and Crazy Rich Asians fame. and it is about
Is it Awkwafina?
Awkwafina.
Yeah, what did I say?
You said Awkwafina.
It's funny. Awkwafina is how I read it when she popped on the scene. Then recently I noticed that it was actually Awkwafina.
Excuse me for this pronunciation. No, Awkwafina.
But there's a phenomenon to it because I've seen other people misspelling it on the internet as Awkwafina. I think there's just something awkward about the Awkwafina, whereas Aqua looks like, like, oh, I get it, it's water.
Maybe it's a phonetic pun then. That's why she...
I think it's just a name. So, Awkwafina.
I think we're just not used to seeing so many W's in a word. A-W, K-W.
Very much the case. So, Awkwafina is the star of this. She plays a character who finds out that her... of American-Chinese background, living in New York, who finds out that her beloved grandmother in China, where a lot of her extended family live, is dying, but her family made the decision, which, as elicited on the film, is considered very culturally acceptable in China, not to, at least in parts of China, not to tell the grandmother and let her live her at her final, respective final months in peace without the knowledge that her death is imminent. So they all fly over, but they're not, she's said, you can't tell your grandmother anything about this. And it's a very good setup, and the tension is obviously, will someone, or the Awkwafina character, Billy, tell the grandmother of what is happening. This was the best film I caught at the festival. When Lulu Wang did the Q&A, it was a testament to its quality that so many people raised their similar experiences within their own families. Also, in the context of the conversation, two films that premiered this in the past year, Crazy Rich Asians, Always Be My Maybe, came up. I got the impression that Lulu Wang was essentially crazy with these films being lumped into that same category. Certainly both of those films discuss the cultural divide between in Asians living in Asian countries and Asian Americans. And this film, I think, elucidated them on especially well. There's an exceptional scene involving the uncle crying, which is not just hilarious, but the very definition of pathos, one of the best comedy scenes I've seen in film this year. On the matter of the ending, I'm not going to ruin
it. We'll be seeing this movie in a few weeks.
Yes. We'll be
talking about it on the show.
I hope so.
It's a major release of the year.
Let's not farewell it.
We're not going to farewell, but I will wrap up the farewell, but the last point is simply that the ending, it suggests a number of ways the film can go. It really upends its expectations. It's a superb ending, effectively and exceptionally scripted and brought to life by a few excellent performers, including the actress who played the grandmother. And also, you should look up the background to this film and the story of its production. It's as, if not more interesting, and the inspiration thereof too. It's as, if not more interesting than the film itself.
Now, let's talk about the film that you really want to talk about, Glenn, because I know this was not the film you really wanted to talk about. There's another film which you may have hinted that you actually do want to talk about, which you haven't talked about yet.
I
wonder which one it could be.
Is it Kursk? We're going to talk about that film in just 1 minute, but I do want to touch on Kursk because that other conversation got a little bit longer because I'm so excited about that one. But Kursk is the new film with Matthias Schoenhart's Colin Firth, Lea Seydoux.
Cursed indeed.
And Max von Sydow playing this Putin stand-in, much like Matthias Schoenhart himself played a Putin stand-in in Red Sparrow. It is about the 2000 submarine Kursk submarine disaster. And the film, it actually wasn't that great. When you have so much material to draw from, unfortunately...
That is my favorite review of yours.
Well, what are we expecting to say? It's brilliant. No, you have all these Scandinavian people playing Russians.
I know, but your offhandedness about, like, French.
It wasn't that great. Look, there's so much material to draw from here, but they embellish events and thereby turn into very traditional dramatic thriller territory. The politicking of what was going on between the fleets and between the respective governments at the time amid some continuous Cold War era mistrust. It was incredibly interesting. However, that was only suddenly explored in the third act, and it should have been the basis of the film. Having said that, there was one excellent scene, long shots of the order of the day, like holding a camera on someone for 10, 15 minutes or more.
Oh, I was thinking suddenly about the Charlize Theron, Seth Rogen movie, which is infinitely better, called Long Shot, but anyway.
And there's one that takes place underwater as they go through the tunnels of the submarine, and that was excellent. Otherwise, it could very well not be as good as Long Shot. I haven't seen Long Shot.
It's wonderful.
The last film I want to discuss from the Melbourne International Film Festival is one we'll be discussing in coming weeks when everyone else has had a chance to see it, and which I can't wait to be in cinemas, And it's this Earth Nightingale, the best Australian film of the year. And it is called Little Monsters. Oh my God. This came out of the radar. And it is just, I adore this movie. It stars Lupita Nyong'o in the best monster movie she's made this year. Much better than us. As a kindergarten teacher, Miss Carolyn, who is kindergarten teacher to nephew of our main character, played by Alexander England, who's down in his out, living in his sister's couch, but has a crush on Miss Carolyn and wants to impress her, takes the kids down on the field trip, and of course, zombie apocalypse ensues from, they came out of the US military base next door in the Australian suburbs. That may seem strange and ridiculous, but this film was operating at a lightly ironic tone, which never exceeds level of believability or internal logic, therefore...
Always happens when you have a crush on your teacher, right? You know, eventually end up in a zombie apocalypse, so.
Sure. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I hope not. I sincerely hope not.
Serves you right to have a crash, eh?
And this movie, it never exceeds those bounds of like. I believe someone would have a crush on their. It's believable that someone would have a crush on like their nephew's primary school or kindergarten teacher. Elements of this are not believable otherwise, but they establish a level of believability and logic and never exceed that. And to that end. There's a it's surprisingly tightly scripted. There's a lot that goes on in this movie. It's very tightly packed. And as good as Lupita Nyong'o is, she's the standout of the film. She has wonderful one-liners. Josh Gad as Teddy McGiggles, this Krusty the Clown-esque, jaded children's entertainer who has to laugh and be happy with children all the time. I'm only saying good things about it. The only thing I didn't like about it.
You compared Josh Gad to like Krusty McCloudface.
Krusty the Clown is one of the most endearing characters of modern television, and Josh Gad is hilarious, and it's my favorite performance of his since The Book of Mormon. And while I don't think the lead, Alexander England, is up to the level of Nyong'o or Gad, there's a lot of hilarious moments herein. And you know what? It's actually filmed in Sydney. It's filmed down the road, so I'm going to go to have a picnic at the local ground there. Two final things in this film. One, so it has some excellent. For any Taylor Swift fans out there, Lover's coming out in 2 days. There's a lot of you'll enjoy this movie.
The real reason why you like this movie.
No, it's a small element thereof, but it is idiosyncratic to my taste. I'm not going to lie. Two things about this film that are really good on a light and a serious subject. One, there's massive Star Wars mania lately, as we were discussing in the ad break, and this film seems, at least apparently. To be trying to cash in on a lot of the classic imagery. Oh, you like Star Wars. Everyone likes Star Wars. Let's throw some Star Wars imagery in there. Star Wars imagery is so used.
But this one has a different approach, right? Because Jar Jar Binks is the main symbol of Star Wars fandom. Am I correct?
Well, Jar Jar Binks is the main Sith Lord. Let's not...
But in Little Monsters, do we get to see a lot of beautiful Jar Jar imagery?
I wish there'd be Jar Jar imagery in this film. I mean, I would have been fine with more Star Wars imagery in this film because they're good in how they handle it. There's two excellent sequences involving Star Wars imagery, and they find novel ways to deploy it. Unfortunately, no, I'm sorry I'm ruining the film, but Jar Jar Binks is not in it, Chris. So.
Oh, man.
Well, it's still better than how the Dead Don't Die decide to use Star Wars. So.
That is true, except for the keyring. That was pretty funny. Lastly, on a serious subject... actually, I shouldn't treat it so seriously, but it is a serious subject. In the recent years, with regards to Australian cinema, there has been some controversy as to, I haven't seen the film, as to how allergic reactions are depicted on film. And certainly, as someone who had to carry an epinephrine around at a younger age, just like one of the main characters in this film, it's something that's not generally covered in movies. This, and for a zombies, ridiculous gore fest of all things, contains a serious allergic reaction. The film doesn't play it for comedy. It is faithful without much embellishment as to what would actually happen. And while it is used as a catalyst for some dramatic action, it isn't used for over the top or extraneous or to a gratuitous extent. And I appreciated that. Amidst a lot of ridiculous carnage, there was a considered and sensitive approach to a serious subject. That does recommend the film, as does so many other aspects. So yeah, I can't wait to discuss this more in coming months.
I'm sure we'll have to. I mean, what I mean to say is, I'm sure the film deserves that kind of discussion.
And anyone doesn't like. And when it comes to we'll play some Taylor because Taylor is the theme music. I finally get to play Taylor on this show. My God.
Okay. Fair warning. How gory is the movie? Because
it's not very gory. It's jokey gory. Mostly,
depends how much blood I'm supposed to see.
No, you won't bother.
I remember piercing.
If you can handle the Dead Don't Die, you can handle this.
Oh, yeah, okay then. Yeah. Okay, cool, cool.
So that is the Melbourne International Film Festival.
A couple of beheadings is okay.
Yeah. Some more than a few beheadings.
And all right, okay, you definitely missold this movie to me.
You'll enjoy this film. I actually can't wait to show it to friends and everyone.
Okay, you're a little monster. Okay.
Oh, thank you, man. So, perfect. This is actually a terrible segue to the next film, but anyway, we're going to segue to our spoilers discussion of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It is in cinemas now. It is, as you may have heard, the 9th film from Quentin Tarantino. Warning, we are doing a full-on spoilers discussion of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. From here in, you have been warned. Okay, so we discussed the film last week. Virat's going to give us his take, and he's going to give us his take in context of the entire film. Before we get into that, for those who aren't interested in seeing it, we described the film last week. It is about Rick Dalton, the Leonardo DiCaprio character, an aging TV cowboy who lives down the road from Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski, played by Margot Robbie in this film, and believes that he's a bit of a has-been and wants to reach greater career aspirations.
Just to be clear, Sharon Tate is not played by Margot Robbie. Yeah. Margot Robbie does not play Polanski.
Yes. I did notice that. I'm like, no, the audience is going to get it, but thank you. But I'm glad that was pointed out. Margot Robbie does not play Roman Polanski. It would be terrible casting.
No, that would be interesting. That would make this film more interesting than it was.
That's the Surrey Hills Theatre version of this film.
Well, honestly, that way more engaging than it actually was for me.
And
anyway.
Brad Pitt plays Cliff Booth, Dalton's best and only friend. He's driver and stuntman. And it recalls the era immediately preceding the horrific Tate-LaBianca murders in Hollywood and the loss of innocence of Hollywood. What happens in the film, which we weren't able to discuss last week, is a few things which we're going to elucidate on simply because it will form the basis of discussion. There is a sequence, a flashback sequence, where it is heavily implied but not clear as to whether Cliff Booth, when on a boat with his wife, killed her. And obviously, and while he was cleared of any charges, many in Hollywood believe that he is guilty of this offense and moderate the treatment of him accordingly. There's a scene where he fights Bruce Lee, and they almost go for 3 rounds. They each win 1 round, and they don't go into a 3rd round. Bruce Lee is portrayed as a very arrogant and haughty figure in this. There's a sequence where they visit the ranch with all the Manson disciples, and Cliff Booth finds Bruce Dern, the owner of the ranch, has something to do with them, living with I forget her name, but the Dakota Fanning character who was jailed for attempting to assassinate President Gerald Ford. Cliff Booth attacks one of the ranch hands on this ranch. And then at the end of the film, there's a sequence where three of the disciples intending to target Polanski and Robbie instead decide, after having met Rick Dalton in the adjoining driveway, to target Rick Dalton. They go into Rick Dalton's house. Cliff Booth is absolutely high in a very gory and violent and graphic ways alongside his dog. Proceeds to how should we put this? He lights one.
Maul.
He mauls.
And then Darth Maul flames.
No. She goes out into the pool and she's screaming. Rick Dalton flame throws.
They die. So what do we think of the movie?
They die.
The disciples die. The dead don't die. Whatever, people die. But okay, what did I think of the movie? This movie is interesting in different ways, but also equally frustrating for me to watch. Mostly because I find it very hard to emotionally connect and feel nostalgic about the era that Tarantino wants us to feel nostalgic about. I wish that I was, except I think apart from DiCaprio's very interesting aging star and very emotionally fragile portrayal of a has-been movie star, and I think he played that really interestingly about how he describes at every instant, which is pretty funny.
Not funny, it's sad.
It is sad, but also I think it is deliberately funny as well. Where I think the movie's disparate structure is what probably held it back for me to actually understand it. And that's probably why Chris would like it as well, because it doesn't try to attempt to tell you any kind of linear story. And I am seeing Chris nodding because I think exactly the kind of thing Chris would appreciate in this movie, which I find it very hard to connect with. But also, I think the movie does work best when it's trying to pontificate about, what the era and culture it has been. I think there are a lot of guest appearances from famous actors, and they come around and they do talk about the changing of the guard and changing of the times and what that means for cinema. But also, I think it is Tarantino's way of talking about himself. So it is almost a commentary about his generation of filmmakers and how that's a lost generation, and how the way that you make movies now is pretty much altered beyond repair. And the kind of movies that he's loved and the kind of generation of filmmakers that he's grown up with is now forever lost.
It's very much, I think, he's drawing on this 50 years ago era as something analogous to the way that a lot of people are feeling now, that our time is coming to a close. Now it's the broader kind of thing about cinema, you know, the American film industry as it pertains to ideas of artistry, you know, that I think a lot of people are feeling pessimistic and thinking that's going away now with the increasing focus on franchises and the increasing corporatization of the studio system. But I think that as an, you know, those contemporary relevances were enough to draw me into the story, because you were saying you don't have that much fondness to the time period or that much knowledge. I know basic facts about it, but I'm not particularly nostalgic for that sort of thing either. I don't have that much exposure to the kind of culture that Tarantino is playing around with in this film, but I still found it really transporting. Just to see the level of detail in recreating the texture of the pop culture, the graphic design, radio ads, trailers, movies, the notions of movie starness or how heroes should present themselves on screen. It's so obsessively detail-oriented that I found it transporting. I think I felt Tarantino's love for that time, even though I don't especially feel that love, but for me that wasn't alienating. For me that was like inviting.
It is, and it's interesting in that sense also about how each of the characters, especially let's say Rick and Cliff, are both performing even when they're not performing in some sense. So I think this idea of the camera is never off, and I think it is definitely emblematic of a time when you were supposed to carry your image even off camera, and the pressure of just being a superstar and a star in the studio system was probably all-encompassing. And now we have, I think, but also in terms of directors, and now we are moving to a generation where Tarantino and like that generation of directors, Scorsese, and we're talking about your last kind of bastion of filmmakers being the actual stars, right? And now we're moving to a corporate studio-driven...
Well, not just that.
But the studios are the stars.
But this movie is also very much about the idea of movie stars, which are also something that's going away. And this Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt are two of the last people who I think fit the traditional model of a movie star in terms
of three.
But
I think Tarantino's also...
Including
them,
I can think of three.
Yeah.
Also trying to like be self-referential and talk about this the last generation of directors being the real stars, you know, that... I find it hard how to now sell a Hollywood movie beyond like a Quentin Tarantino film sells the movie, right? We're seeing this because this is the ninth.
He's become a brand, yeah.
It's not a genre. I think there's a distinction here. Yeah. His films are treated as a genre, which is why many will go into this with certain expectations of its style. Some of my issues with this was not so much that it wasn't like other Tarantino films, but that it wasn't as visually creative as Tarantino films. Having said that, I don't think this is a film which harks back to a bygone era of when director stars. It doesn't really. Polanski's in it for what, 30 seconds. It does have a huge amount of nostalgia for when stars were ageless, as Norman Desmond would put it. And it's I do like that it is starring one of the last great stars who can reckon with the image of this era.
I would feel for Tarantino, and I think that's for me that came across very fondly, is that for him the real stars are the directors, and I feel. What he's trying to say is that the star system is bound to fail if the directors are not given that kind of power.
Tarantino loves actors as well. Tarantino, when he was a kid, before he wanted to be a director, wanted to be an actor because until he understood what a director does. And there's a reason why he keeps casting himself in all his films, despite being... He doesn't in this one, notably, but he's a terrible actor. I think he's really... he loves actors. I think he's really attached to that idea of the actor. And this movie... is in a way that hasn't been in vogue in filmmaking for decades, really just about feeling it's not just about, but one of the things it's about is feeling the pleasure of being in the presence of a star. Like the stuff with Brad Pitt, just watching him driving around, chilling out, watching, you know, the little nuances in the way that he interacts with hitchhikers, the way he feeds his dog, the way, you know, a gratuitous shirtless scene where he's standing in the sun on a rooftop,
yeah,
the way that he sort of just effortlessly can navigate any of the problems that face his way.
Yeah, he's playing the real Steve McQueen in this. Damian Lewis was not good in this movie, and yeah.
I found that this, in addition to the kind of texture of the pop culture I was talking about, I found these things were just really pleasurable to watch. And I think the length actually works to the film's favor here, because it's about relaxing with these characters so that you can look at the smaller details. The performances are so layered and detailed. The production design, I find this movie is just radiating these like golden Californian vibes, sunshine vibes, you know.
I would agree with you, except I felt the tone was a bit misplaced, and I would want it to be a more sprawling mess to kind of feel that kind of experience.
It is actually, yeah. But a lot of people are saying
kind of sprawlingness of it, if Tarantino overindulged in that side of things, actually it would have helped, what I would feel.
Yeah, a lot of people are saying that this movie is really like all over the place. There's no story, but it's long. It allows sections to really get played out, but there is actually quite a tight structure there in terms of, you know, at the beginning it sets out our characters with a problem. You see how it breaks up to show you how they deal with it along the way, and then there's a climax at the end. It's a pretty traditional kind of story. It's just that the approach Tarantino's here, which when you were talking about his status as a brand and as a star, no other director I can think of in Hollywood would be able to get a film like this made.
On this level, no.
Yeah.
Scorsese could do it. Eastwood could do it.
Scorsese, yeah, that's true. But yeah, a film that deviates so much from, like I was saying, in ways of character development and laying out the threads of its story, it is traditional. But it just takes on a different kind of feeling by allowing things to play out for so long as they do. Like instead of just having a scene where Rick Dalton stars in a TV pilot, he goes in doubting himself, but he regains a little bit of confidence in his career. We see that entire shoot play out, and the movie becomes Tarantino's visualization of the pilot episode of the show. I think that gives you so much more time to absorb the kind of texture of the 1960s mass pop culture stuff that Tarantino's trying to evoke. I don't think it would be the same if he had just given us the Cliff Notes condensed down dramatic version. I think that the sprawling, what could otherwise be self-indulgence, and I think just serves the aims of the film and the subject matter.
I think there's a tightness for what could have been a 100-minute movie. This goes significantly longer. It's 161 minutes. The opening sections establish a traditional plot, and then you have about an hour and a half substantively, which is I'm deliberately meandering, and therefore I think it loses track of itself. I think the audience can deliberately lose interest until the very end, which is a piece of really flashy showmanship. With regards to how it evokes this era, I have an interest in this era of Hollywood. I've read a lot of books in it. I've seen a lot of films about it. But I don't think this goes beyond any of the many films which seek to emulate and create an idea of what classical Hollywood is. Certainly some of the best depictions thereof have occurred contemporaneously. I referenced the Bleak Sunset Boulevard earlier. Some of the modern depictions of Hollywood, as much as I didn't really enjoy much of La La Land for its musical bona fides, its depiction of what the Hollywood of today is like works very well. I think he's playing stronger. The problem is I feel Tarantino, and it's very clear in some of the individuals and characters he picks out. Not many people know who the Al Pacino character is, but he has a pride of place in the film. It's very inside baseball in that so many in Hollywood, this will appeal instinctively not just to people who, not necessarily people who know Hollywood or read up on a lot of it, but who are ingrained in an active part of the industry. He's playing to the people in the Kodak
Theater.
It is
about Hollywood.
And that is what the issue is to me. It's not playing to me. And I may have a little bit more of an interest in this era than Frank Marlowe, but still, I don't think that is necessarily relevant, given that he's not playing to us.
I could actually, I said this last week, but for me, I think that Tarantino found the universals about it so that it didn't just work on the level of the specific. I'm thinking I mean, clearly he's looking at how this can be a metaphor for a lot of things, because we've got the scene where Rick Dalton tells his young co-star on the Lancer pilot shoot about this book he's reading about
the scenes of the movie.
Yeah, about this Bronco rider who's feeling like he's getting a little bit long in the tooth and feeling a little bit more useless every day. I think in the same way that, you know, the plot of this film could be reflected in this Western book, that we as the audience can find a way into this story, even if you're not caught up in the inside baseball of Hollywood.
I kind of feel there are two Tarantinos which are caught up in this film, and I would have liked it more if Tarantino committed to one of those personas that he's trying to pursue. Like I think Glenn mentioned, and you mentioned as well, initially it sets out a very conventional structure, and then towards the end it has a very flashy Tarantino-esque, you know, surprise twist ending.
Which is good. I like the ending.
Which is okay. But
it'd be good to discuss the ending, actually.
Yeah. I kind of felt like either if the film was that meandering philosophical, you know, meta take on that, I would have loved to watch that film, or I would have loved to watch the quintessential Tarantino movie, which it sets up in like the first opening minutes and then the climax, which is very Tarantino. Because suddenly I'm like, oh, so like he's trying to kind of have its cake and eat it too. Like, you know, for most of the film, you're trying to really change my perspective of what you can do and actually trying to evoke a sensibility and trying to make me feel like it's an experience of trying to relive that era. And then I kind of felt cheated by the end, where I was trying to jolt it back into this Tarantino universe and be like, oh, I can still do this as well, by the way. Which I'm like,
that was the catharsis he was going for. He was always going for that.
It was not cathartic. I think I kind of felt cheated by that. Because I'm like, you know, let me belong to one universe, because you've clearly done a lot of work in trying to show me that you can invest in that other side of the universe that you want me to be a part of. But let me just be there then.
I'm super torn on this ending. To be honest, I'm usually torn on the... I was torn on the Inglourious Basterds ending as well, actually. This one functions in a little bit of a different way. I think
I should clarify before you continue that at the end, if for those who haven't seen it, in addition to what I said earlier, at the very end of the film, while Cliff Booth has been injured, Rick Dalton comes across the other residents in the home of Polanski and Margot Robbie, and they hear what's happened. Oh, come, we don't know you, neighbor. Come into our house to drink and be merry and be a part of our lives. And so it ends on a very high note.
Yeah. Part of me is thinking, okay, Tarantino, we've seen the historical revision give the characters their imagined cinematic revenge thing in Inglourious Basterds and Django Unchained, and wouldn't it be more mature right now to just actually face up and to the truth of the history of the situation you're depicting? But you can view this from another angle. Maybe Tarantino thinks it's more mature to make these kinds of narratives about events where we all know what really happened, so you can say, this is the movie, this is what movies do, you know, that maybe it's more honest to do it this way than to come up with a similarly outlandish fictional story in the 60s that sells the idea that something like this could ever have happened this way about it. Instead, he's making more of a nostalgic point about the magic of the cinema, you know, that the once upon a time in the end is really with the bittersweet. I think it's a Morricone track that plays as the credits kick on. There really is the sense that he's saying, wouldn't it be nice if reality could be like this? And he's celebrating the power of the cinema to give people happy endings. And he's acknowledging it's not just a fantasy that he's selling you as something that could really happen. So there's an inherent kind of sadness in what he's doing here, which is, even though I'm kind of conflicted on it, it's still in that regard one of the probably the most successful historical revisionistic ending he's given.
All right, just on the before we get to the historical revisionism, the ensuing sequence itself was the preceding sequence. It's very entertaining. It's very well staged. It's the only time he actually gets in the entire film, excepting to an extent the Bruce Lee sequence, to really show Tarantino at his, you know, just violent, vile best.
Tarantino is an action director.
Yeah, and it's the only action scene really in the whole movie, aside from the Bruce Lee scene, which is very statically shot. This was very good. On the matter of historical revisionism,
can we talk just about the violence actually briefly?
Yes. We'll put a pin in historical revisionism. Yeah. Come back to that.
Yeah. Just with you mentioning him at his violent best. I mean, I'll admit this. I laughed when this sequence kicked in because the tonal whiplash. Oh,
absolutely.
From just the tension to just suddenly this outrageous, way over the top, horrific violence being perpetrated by Cliff Booth. But I could see some people being like genuinely horrified by it. Yeah, I don't know. It's just
not as extreme as anything. A lot of stuff in Django Unchained, or Pulp Fiction, or Inglourious Bastards.
Yeah, I think.
But it is more intimate, the violence. It was in many of the occasions in those films.
It's super gratuitous in the way that the wailing of some of the Manson family characters just keeps on going. So you're realizing
kind of really does.
Yeah, you're witnessing some like pretty extreme suffering, and it's being played as a joke. And to an extent, that can go either way for people. I think.
Yeah. I think Tarantino is just assuming, I think rightly in many cases, that people just not care what happens to Charles Manson disciples and is happy to see them go up in flames.
Yeah, but also, I wonder if that's sort of like an excuse that allows him to indulge this kind of sick impulse. I don't know.
Also just the visuals of like glass shards sticking out of the face, like the mold face was...
It's pretty heavy.
Pretty.
Even if it's played in a kind of cartoony way. All this being said, I loved...
And again, they were there to kill someone, so actions that were taken in that scene, not all actions, but some actions, at least initially, were in self-defense. So it begins at a very different register to a scene, unlike in many of these other films, like The Hateful Eight is a key example, which are just entirely gratuitously violent.
But it kind of did make me feel like the violence is a resultant of the absurdity of the situation to begin with, rather than a planned action, which is what happened. So the revisionist aspect is like, you know, this is less planned than people realize it, and it's things happen to line up.
But he's not calling to the absurdity of the situation. The situation was sadly real, and people like that exist very tragically. What he's commenting on is the absurdity of those figures and trying to marry the reaction with how loud and terrible they are.
I like that he's just mocking these people. I love Brad Pitt, Cliff Booth, just saying that the famous, you know, I'm the devil and I'm here to do the devil's work line is just dumb. I like that it's mocking these characters, but... Maybe it's just kind of like getting sick of Tarantino's quirks. And this is such a refreshing Tarantino film in being so unlike what his last few features have been like. Harkening back, I would say, to Jackie Brown in the way that it tries to create this good times vibe and let scenes play out for ages. But it just feels like such a disappointment to go back to this kind of gratuitous violence for no reason, I think.
Yeah.
Like,
I don't think he's not doing it for no reason. I think he's using it selectively. More selectively than he's used in any film.
That's true. It is very much being done selectively, but it's so on-brand, and even though, yes, he can pull off this kind of sequence well, you can make fun of the Manson characters and change history without necessarily going into this kind of territory again.
It could have had the initial mauling, and that it could have stopped
Look,
there.
Honestly, they could have been talked out of it.
What are the non-Tarantino films?
Maybe
what are the film that was distinct from his Uruv, essentially?
Well,
or would he be happy with that?
But seriously, they could have been talked out of it.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's a movie of conversations. You know, like,
can you imagine them being talked out of and just walking home?
Yeah.
If you play it well enough, like the ending of Pulp Fiction.
And everyone kind of goes, and you know, they instead, you know, you can still have the high ending of like, you know, Cliff and going with.
But we're talking about a different movie now. What we have is this explosion of movie-like violence.
But it's interesting because I think the movie makes enough of a point to actually ridicule the Mansons without the gratuitousness.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm not enough of that. Yeah, I'm not upset about these scenes. I think they're well played off, and I love the movie. I just think it's like food for thought.
Yeah, it's but it totally did kind of. Sort of prick me as to
again.
People would have known.
That's it. We've seen Tarantino pull these kind of tricks a few times.
People would have known it was a Tarantino film if that scene hadn't been included. They could have watched it not thinking it was a Tarantino
movie.
To me,
it's refreshing is the fact that he was trying to make a different kind of film in the middle, and then he lost that opportunity because he just couldn't commit to it.
To me, a lot of the sides of Tarantino that I love most are in this movie. The long scene at the Spahn Ranch is such a tense potboiler, like something out of Inglourious Bastards. I love the way that he just builds up the tension.
It's very Hannibal Lecter, Silence of the Lambs, walk down to the jail cell. It's one of the best stage scenes in the whole film.
And
Stone is very good. And the scene at the car where he just walks out and they're all just standing there staring at this outsider.
What's great about that scene is Cliff, you know, while Rick Dalton is going off being a Western star, there's the theme about how Cliff Booth does the real stuff. I think the hippie Manson girl played by Margaret Qualley makes the comment that it's good you're a stuntman and not an actor, because actors just lie. You actually really do something. And the movie kind of shows that in a few ways. In the climax, it's Cliff Booth who fights off all the attackers, does almost all the work, and it seems like Rick Dalton who's going to get the publicity.
Yeah.
But in this sequence,
he does get to walk off and
walk into the sunset. Yeah. In this sequence, we're cutting between Rick Dalton on the set of a Western, and then Cliff Booth, who's actually in a Western. The space that's been used to film an Old West town is now becoming a place where an outsider stumbles into town, and the sheriff comes in, and the villagers have a dark secret, and they're all hanging, watching him, from the side of the saloon.
Oh, it's marvelous.
Like, movies becoming real.
It was really romantic and marvelous to watch when Austin Butler was told about Cliff Booth being there and just turned on the horse and ran towards him. And felt
beautiful shot.
He's playing Elvis. Can't wait.
Right.
Historical revisionism.
There's a lot I like about this movie. Can we talk about the question of, you mentioned earlier the backstory about Cliff Booth's wife.
I do want to get into that, but I want to talk about the historical revisionism first, because this is a completely distinct thing. So you referred to earlier to two other Tarantino films where he pulls this, but they're so different. And I actually think it's used best in this case. And it's used very differently three times. We're going to ruin the endings of Inglourious Basterds, Django Unchained now, if you've not seen these films. Inglourious Basterds, they kill Hitler, they kill a bunch of Nazi high command, and effectively bringing an end to World War II, as is heavily implied much earlier. This is very distinct from this film in that World War II ultimately did end with the Nazis being killed and the Allies and winning. With Django Unchained, while this exact event did
Django.
Not... did not occur, versions of it did, and there are reports of like events occurring. It's based on a particular event, may very well be, but it's not explicitly so. This is changing the history of an event which we know, a very tragic event. And I talked earlier last week about how good Margot Robbie was with the smile on the side. And my favorite moment of her is her just smiling, and she wants to buy a ticket to her own movie. And it creates this portrait of what was lost, and there's something incredibly poignant in him walking up to a very alive Sharon Tate, and that, as much as Robbie's performance imparted what is tragically gone now, what this world is without, that poignancy, that it feels like such a happy ending, but it's underlined by us knowing this is such an absurd portrait and inversion of what real life is, that envelops and grows what was a very good performance by Robbie. So I think it's used better in this.
It's making the point that this is what movies are, and we wish that Margaret,
wish that life was like this.
Yeah, and movies give us that. And it's giving Margaret, Sharon Tate, the idea of Sharon Tate screen time again.
Yeah.
It's his version of reversing the injustice. One of the things I do like for this film, people have been debating, is Margot Robbie really a character in this? Is there enough of her?
Absolutely.
I think
it's outrageous to suggest that any performer, at least for someone of her caliber, cannot evince a character absent lines commensurate with those of her co-stars.
Well, the question, I guess, would be of what Tarantino was going for in not giving her much dialogue. I think, honestly, that he's treating her in a lot of ways as a symbol. I think maybe also part of it is that
she's also aspirational, and I think that's what he's setting up to, right?
Yeah.
And it's aspirational. It's kind of, because even for Rick and Cliff, she's, once removed, she's still, something beyond reach, much like real movie stars are for us.
And I think also to Tarantino, maybe she is beyond reach a little bit as well. Like, he doesn't give that many lines to many of the characters playing real historical figures in this film. They get basically cameo appearances at most.
Now, moving to the next subject, which is one of the most, if not the most controversial aspects of this film, which is the matter of not only whether Cliff Booth did kill his wife, but the question that issues.
I would say Bruce Lee would be the the most controversial aspect of this film.
Okay. Actually, should we discuss that before we get into...
Sure.
So, Bruce, in the Bruce Lee sequence, Cliff Booth nails him in one scene, in one of the rounds. Bruce Lee wins the other. There's never a third round. Bruce Lee is depicted as haughty and arrogant, and his daughter, among others, who knew him objected to this depiction. Tarantino has rejected this. There are a few ways to look at this. One is the perspective that, hey, it's a film, it's a fictional movie, people can be depicting their characters, they can depict whatever they want. Certainly, moreover, in this film, not only is this fictional, but this scene is couched in a recollection by Cliff Booth that is made very clear, so unreliable narrator, etc. However, I feel there is a distinction that really needs to be made here.
I think there are some... The way that Tarantino's defended this is by saying, of course, Cliff Booth can do anything I say he can. Cliff Booth is a fictional character. And I think there is kind of a meta touch to this earlier in the film when we think back to the producer and scout played by Al Pacino saying that to introduce that a new guy is tough, you show him beating the guy who used to be the heroes. So I think that's kind of playing out with the idea of Cliff Booth being able to take on the ultimate legend, Bruce Lee, to set us up for the idea that, as the old TV shows would with new actors, that this Cliff Booth guy is super tough. I think that is what Tarantino is going for.
But also, I think it's part of the meta commentary where it's based on Cliff Booth's recollection, so you can never really trust it.
I took it that this is Cliff Booth's recollection, that this is actually what really happened.
I agree. I took it that way too. Yeah. I took it literally. But I think we need to make a distinction. I agree with Tarantino philosophically. Hey, a director, a screenwriter wants to depict a character, they have license to do so. If you want to know what the character is like, read up on them. Maybe Bruce Lee was like this, maybe it was faithful, maybe it was completely wrong, I don't know. But there's a distinction with this particular movie because he depicts either people who are real, like Sharon Tate, I forget the name of the Al Pacino character, but he's a real person, he's a real famous agent, or amalgams of characters, real life famous people into one or few characters and amalgams of the Hollywood environment. I think with Tate, as we discussed earlier, he is putting her up if exaggerated, still faithful version of what she was like in real life, and therefore underlying the poignancy of her death. He does this with other characters too. I think if you're going to take that approach with your main real life character, it is fair to expect the audiences will interpret that you're taking a similar, not a similar approach to your other characters. With Bruce Lee, yes, it may be an exaggerated portrayal, but I think it's a reasonable interpretation that Tarantino is proffering or implying that this was very much what Bruce Lee was like. And maybe he was like that, but to the extent that Bruce Lee wasn't like that, I think that's unreasonable and unfair to Bruce Lee's legacy.
I think a lot of criticism has come from the fact that you have only one Asian American, you know, major character that you're...
Absolutely, because he's such an aspirational character in terms of Asian American people in pop culture,
and representation,
and that he's being beaten by a white guy. So yeah, people view it as like another. I don't think this is what Tarantino is intended. I think Tarantino is legitimately a huge Bruce Lee fan.
Yeah.
There have been tributes to Bruce Lee in a lot of his films, but I think people do view this as another way that the white Hollywood system takes down the Asian hero, down a few pegs.
And I think, so the kind of racial politics around it and representation politics kind of does murky the waters a little bit in terms of how people would have wanted to have seen this play out. And I do kind of see the point, if you are going to be consistent in portraying your major characters in a nostalgic sense, there is a certain level of once removed coldness towards Bruce Lee's portrayal, which is not afforded to any other sort of metafictional or real character. Certainly a bit more fun. Like, you know, it kind of does strike you as to like, oh, so if everyone in Hollywood is supposed to be aspirational, Bruce Lee doesn't come across as aspirational in any sense in this movie. So there is a level of kind of jarring thing if you are looking at those characters in kind of a conglomerate collective sense. So I can see that point, but mostly it is about representation and what Bruce Lee's individual representation kind of stands out like a sore thumb.
And it's got to be said, Mike Moe was very good.
Oh yeah, he was.
Bruce Lee. It's actually a bang-on impression.
Was really good.
Yeah. The movie does give you the other side to Bruce Lee as well in the flash cutaway we get when Margot Robbie is Sharon Tate's watching the Wrecking Crew, and then suddenly we cut to Bruce Lee training her, which apparently is what actually happened, to do the kung fu moves in her film.
So that was the Bruce Lee aspect of this. The next aspect, as we want to discuss, is the broad implications and the sequence itself where of the sequence where it is heavily implied, not clear, that Brad Pitt's character Cliff Booth may have or likely killed his wife. The sequence, the sequence takes place. We're told right before the sequence occurs that that someone can't believe that Rick Dalton's friends with him because he killed his wife. He was cleared of any charges, though it is widely understood in Hollywood, as we are led to believe, that it is understood that Cliff Booth did this. There's a flashback sequence with Cliff Booth on a boat. The boat's rocking up and down. He's got a spear gun in his hand. His wife is arguing with him.
Spear gun is pointed at her.
And this last scene is just him looking up at her holding the spear gun. The boat rocks a little, and then we cut back to Cliff Booth in modern day. I have a view on this. I don't think people will debate whether Cliff Booth actually did it or not. I don't think that's whether he did it or not is the point the filmmaker's trying to get across. I would not be surprised if Tarantino didn't have a view as to whether he did it or not. I think the point he's trying to make is that Tarantino and a number of others have been have been implicated in the Me Too movement, and it's like. Certainly there's been a lot of publicity around Tarantino's alleged treatment of Uma Thurman on the set of Kill Bill, and notably this is the first film in a very long time that Quentin Tarantino has not made without Harvey Weinstein. Tarantino may be very well be antithetical to some of the precepts of the Me Too movement, and certainly Cliff Booth is portrayed primarily in this film, we discussed the end at length, as a caring person who looks after those loved ones in his life and only reacts with violence when in self-defense or when goaded by Bruce Lee.
Though, as we said, he does go pretty overboard in terms of his violence at the end of the film.
Yes, he does. But nonetheless, he is portrayed ultimately as a good figure, and certainly potentially as an avatar for many of those who may feel critical of the Me Too movement or have been implicated or alleged to have committed acts themselves. I don't think Quentin Tarantino is concerned as to whether Cliff Booth did anything. I think he's concerned in that I think he's making it more than an implicit comment that in the absence of proof or a case, proof in the sense of a legal verdict, that a person committed a crime, that they shouldn't be judged, punished, and maligned. And it could be a view he holds, and certainly it is not unapparent that this is a heavy heft of the criticism, which is of Cliff Booth's character and his placement in the movie.
I think potentially that is still a point worth making, but the way this movie does it and the circumstances surrounding it mean that I can't help but view this as kind of smug. Like, for a guy that has been, at the very least guilty of, as he admitted to, you know, doing nothing to prevent Weinstein, you know, that he had knowledge, and like most people, and many, many people who won't admit to it, as Tarantino did, I think, you know, stood by because they think, oh, this is just the system works. It's weird for someone so close to that situation to, in his immediate film following that, do a kind of like, well, innocent until proven guilty.
It's
message.
Almost like when Kevin Spacey put out that video of Where Your Hearts of Cards.
Yeah, it's almost like I'm making it so blatant in this movie, like, you can't catch me. Like, not to cast any aspersions on Tarantino. I don't profess to know anything about, and I'm not saying anything about Tarantino himself.
Yes.
But it's so weird to the way that this movie plays it so close to the line of whether this guy did it or not. And it's basically creating a situation where this isn't some vague thing, like there's this mysterious thing, but he has a good alibi or whatever. It's the scene plays out like this is a guy about to kill his wife,
and I think that there is to your interpretation,
yeah,
deliberately.
But I think there's a what makes it ugly, regardless of what we're meant to believe or if we're meant to believe anything about whether Cliff Booth did it or not, is that Tarantino almost seems to be going for laughs in that scene. Like, isn't it funny that a guy shoots his wife because she's just being, you know, dismissive of him and tearing him apart? Like, it feels like that's meant to be funny. And then
convenience to get rid of.
Yeah, exactly. But if he is making that point, isn't it then weird to just like unabashedly celebrate this character for the rest of it and say, will you, Tarantino gets to get away with that by saying, well, even though he gives the audience the satisfaction of like, haha, she got what's coming to her, but he says, you know, he keeps the character uncomplicated by saying, well, you didn't see him do it.
And it's very deliberate.
There isn't proof.
It's very the reason I mentioned the waves earlier is that it's very deliberate that the wave bounced when he looked up at her, and the last time we cut from Cliff Booth, it is heavily implied that it's a possibility.
It might be an accident.
It might be an accident. I'm not making a judgment either which way.
Yeah, but
that
scene in her character and the possibility of murder is kind of being played for laughs, yeah. No matter which way it went. Would you agree with that?
I don't disagree at all. My point with raising the issue of the waves is simply that he is deliberately trying to make it ambiguous to a degree while is still heavily implying it. It's very calculated to the end, you have said. It's an incredibly calculated scene.
It's very precise.
Yeah.
But also, I think, points to a larger character trait of Cliff. You know, he does kind of lose control whenever his authority is challenged, whether it is Bruce Lee doing that or his wife, or, you know, towards the end. And you can see a pattern of behavior that Tarantino is trying to establish, especially with his,
right, he's a super, he's like the golden boy otherwise.
Do-gooder man babies who kind of,
yeah,
man baby.
Who lose control when their authorities are challenged, essentially.
Yeah, I think he's the ultimate man. I don't think he's meant to be a man baby. Yeah,
but I would call him a man baby because he's not secure in his authority in terms of...
But the thing is, his character is so secure and so confident in himself in every other way.
Yes.
Not
secure in the sense when...
That's all I'm talking about at all. Even when he loses his job, he still holds it together.
Look,
but that's, I think, part of the generational thing where you're meant to hold it together.
But he does. He's more the classic ideal of classical Hollywood Steve McQueen cool than the Steve McQueen lookalike was in that, or wannabe was in that movie.
Coming out of The Hateful Eight, where we had a lot of, I'm not sure how I'm supposed to react to this kind of scenes of Jennifer Jason Leigh getting belted in the face.
Yeah.
And then ending this one also with a scene of... of prolonged violence against women, which, yes, is in self-defense. But as we were talking about, he really relishes...
Not all of it was in self-defense. Yes.
Yeah, that's right. He really seems to relish in it and stretch it out, at least in his directing choices. I think that in combination with the movie potentially, you know, trying to get you to forgive a guy for killing his wife is... going to make people uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's
the optics there.
Yeah, is there a misogynist streak coming closer to the forefront in Tarantino's films? Should this be read as misogynistic?
Yeah, the concluding line of my review was this: for its stylistic purposes, and these elements will endear as many people as it will alienate. Mm-hmm. And I think this is going to alienate a lot of audiences.
But the timing of this is interesting as well, though, right? Because this is basically you're making a movie. That touches on the Me Too movement, which is about, wouldn't it be great if we could just go back to another age? It's kind of weird, right? Before those hippies took over Hollywood.
Yeah. Before we had to be politically correct.
Yeah.
When men were just good and nice people, and
before when Dennis Hopper was taking food out of the trash instead of becoming a power player, and men were still men on TV.
I think one of the reasons that. One of the calculated reasons that Tarantino more than likely included the final very violent scene was that one of the most infamous and awful acts of violence against a woman in Hollywood history, one of the most well-known, one of the most notorious, is Tarantino's murder. And he subverts a terrible act of violence against a woman and shows...
another act of violence against a woman.
Against women and a man, yes, who were, at least in the film, looking to... commit that act. He
but
wants to subvert
it. So it's weird. It's like she gets to survive because the two because these two macho men, one of whom might have killed his wife, were there to stop it. Like it gets into some weird territory.
But yeah,
like if Cliff Booth killed his wife, isn't it kind of weird to be like, Sharon Tate got to get away because that guy who also kills women.
But it's okay because Cliff Booth got injured too.
But also, it's very strange.
The subversion is not
really... It's discomforting. The whole film is discomforting.
Yeah, I mean, it's a subversion only in a minute sense because one act of violence against a woman is subverted by an act of violence against another woman.
The thing is...
You could have replaced by a man and it could have been like, your point would be easily made.
Even though it would still have been a point about violence. It still would have been using violence.
Here's the thing. Even though some of these things make me feel a little icky to think about... that Tarantino is such a good director that he still kind of sells the fantasy that you can still get swept up in the violence at the end and go, and go home happy.
Yeah, Tarantino likes killing, you know,
yep.
People.
Oh, Tarantino. Yeah. Of course you had to have your...
very violent people.
Your, you know, Tarantino.
Yeah, yeah. There's got to be some blood spray or else the audience goes home unhappy. No. But
thank God it came in the end. You know, I was waiting for it. Where is this scene?
A lot of people I've been talking about have said that. They're like, oh, it was kind of boring, but I really like the ending.
Yeah, people go to a Tarantino movie because they know Django and Chained to Glory, Spartans, Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs, and Jackie Brown. Like, that's...
Yeah.
And, oh, God,
I don't think they go for Jackie Brown.
Less, okay. Less Jackie Brown and less Jackie the film yeah. nerds.
Yeah.
I know, it's a broadly seen movie, but less so than the others, it feels.
Yeah, no, very much so.
Yeah. But...
But yeah, this
yeah. It's, yeah, it's weird.
I
enjoyed the rest of the stuff in the movie so much so that I just kind of forgive this ending and went along with it. But I think it's definitely good that we're talking about it.
Yeah.
I think it
this
should
movie
because
does have a lot to unpack.
Yeah. I think that I don't want to get caught up in the whole, you know, like cancel culture, this movie's canceled thing, you know, because it has stuff
things,
I don't
yeah.
agree with. I'm not saying that people shouldn't oppose things for on moral grounds. I'm just saying there's a lot that's great about this movie. It's worth looking at the complete picture of it. But definitely it's good that we're talking about this stuff because, like I said before, he's so confident as a director that he can just bowl you over with the sensation and you just accept this kind of thing without picking it apart. But I do think it is worth interrogating what messages this is meant to be. Is this really like a conservative movement, you know, essentially story about like wishing that we could go back 50 years because there's a lot and it's
I think he's pinpointed the exact moment when Hollywood lost its innocence and wants to hark back
but as he sees it anyway
but that's
yeah.
the thing right I don't think Hollywood was ever innocent to begin with
yeah I think that there'd been a lot of there was a lot of
there was one
scandal behind the
time.
Scenes yeah. before this but this is a very romantic vision that imagines
yeah.
Hollywood yeah. as being innocent prior to this moment
it's much of a fable yeah once upon a time.
Yeah it's myth more than it probably is a honest picture of Tarantino's feelings about the period but at the same time you do get such a sense of love that
there's a real affection for there, a real affection.
Yeah.
So that is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's in cinemas now. The Melbourne International Film Festival is wrapped. The Korean Film Festival in Australia will be in Dendy Cinemas Opera Keys from tomorrow. If you're listening in Canberra, go have a look at, and I think it's at Palace Electric. And yeah, we'll be back next week talking with Giselle Gallego, the director of the Sydney Latin American Film Festival, which is kicking off at the also in the Opera Keys, I think it is, and at the Anacereth Picture House from September 4th through 21st. Have a wonderful night. Enjoy Tarantino, if that's your thing. Enjoy.
If it's not, that's fine. Just enjoy your kind of movies.
Chris and I will be a year older and wiser.
Yeah, it's your birthdays. Oh my
wiser
God.
Is questionable. Older is true.
Unless you can get one of those zombie viruses that age you back. And just in
Benjamin
time.
Button's disease.
No, what's it called? From Odd Family?
Oh, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I've forgotten.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday to us.
Oh my God, the computer.
20s, which is horrible.
You'll enjoy
it. We survived.
Yeah. Have a wonderful night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Love the movies.